And during some of the toughest times, I have a little piece of paper in my wallet that I keep all the time, even to this moment, of different things that mean to me, different sayings that mean a lot to me, things that I strive for, recognizing my responsibility to give back.
Reoccurring mantra I got into in college where I would just say, I'm going to break the mold.
2 days after my second injury, my dad flew out to Indiana and we drove home, went right up to my room, slept for a day, and then I woke up the next morning, I spray painted my wall, no quitting me. I remember, you know, there is no quitting me and I won't give up.
The number one thing you gotta remember is you're transferring energy. And whatever energy you got is the energy the viewers are gonna have.
You are listening to Intentional Performers with Brian Levinson, where we talk with experts of craft about their journey and what they have intentionally done to be their best self. As we talk with them, the hope is that we uncover intentional gems that you can use in your life. Now, let's kick it over to Brian to introduce this week's guest.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Intentional Performers Podcast. I am Brian Levinson, excited to have you with us today for another great episode. But before we get to today's guest, I'd like to share a bit more about myself. So I work as an executive coach and a mental performance coach, and I founded a company called Strong Skills. At Strong Skills, our team is on a mission to change how the world thinks about soft skills. We believe that labeling competencies like leadership, teamwork, and communication as soft devalues and minimizes the importance of these skills. And one of the strong skills that we teach is what we call shift your mind. The teachings come from my book, which came out last October. If you enjoyed today's conversation or any of our past guests, then I know you're going to love the book. You can head over to Amazon or anywhere books are sold to purchase, and you can even listen to the book via Audible. Thanks to all of you who have already purchased, and I've been overwhelmed by the response the book has gotten so far. Lastly, if you enjoyed today's episode or any of our previous conversations, we'd love it if you went over to iTunes and wrote us a review. It really does help us expand our reach. Thanks to all of you who have already done so. And let's continue to share these intentional, inspiring performers with the world. Speaking of inspiration and impact, today's guest certainly checks those boxes. Damon West is our guest on the podcast today. He was introduced to me by Chris Singleton, who in his own right is an absolute inspiration and one of my favorite guests that we've had on the podcast. And he said, Brian, I think you'd enjoy chatting with Damon. And I said, I'm familiar with Damon because I had John Gordon on the podcast, and Damon and John co-wrote a book together called The Coffee Bean. And the idea around the coffee bean is that when you drop a coffee bean into water, the coffee bean actually impacts the water around it. It turns it into coffee. So it works from the inside out as far as the impact it has versus a carrot or an egg where the water actually impacts the carrot and egg and transforms them. So Damon believes in inside out transformation, and he's got a hell of a story to tell if you're not familiar with it. Today, he is a college professor. He's a nationally known keynote speaker and best-selling author. He is somebody who goes around the country sharing his message. But it wasn't always as bright as it is today. See, at 20 years old, he was a Division I starting quarterback at the University of North Texas when he then suffered a career-ending injury and he turned to hardcore drugs to cope with the disappointments of his life. And after graduation, he worked in the United States Congress, was a national fundraiser on a U.S. presidential campaign, and eventually trained to be a stockbroker for UBS, which is one of the premier financial institutions that we have. And it was at UBS where he was introduced to meth, and he became instantly hooked. And so while you hear these highs and these bright spots and what society often deems a success, Damon looked the part. And yet, he actually battled demons and battled severe substance abuse. And as a result, he impacted the lives of many innocent people from choices that he made in order to feed his meth habit. He robbed a lot of people, He became a burglar. He ran an organized crime ring, and he really got into some heavy stuff. And it actually led to his incarceration. And Damon went to jail for 7+ years, but he was actually convicted for 65. And at the time of his conviction, 65 years is basically a life sentence. And so he spent time in hardcore prison. He's going to talk about his experience there. He's going to talk about what he learned in prison, what he learned about race and racism. And he's going to talk about really the sociology that he got to witness while in jail, and also his awakening and how he has learned to transform his life and his experience. And we don't get into it in too much detail, but there are people that impacted Damon along the way. He got clean while he was in prison. And today, he really is inspiring the world with a story of redemption, grit, and determination. So he inspires audiences all over the world. So Damon admits he's still in recovery. He's still an addict. He is still somebody who is focused on giving to others and being in service. He's spoken to some of the biggest names in business and in sport. He's spoken to football teams like Clemson, Alabama, Georgia, and Texas. He will talk about some of the businesses that he has gotten the opportunity to serve. And actually, we're going to start this conversation with what Damon is most passionate about, which is a nonprofit that he is involved with and really leveraging to impact our school systems in a profound way. But rather than tell you more about that, I'm going to let him jump in and dive in and share what he's up to. So without further ado, I'm so excited to present to you Damon West. Damon, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Excited to chat with you, learn from you today. We're going to talk about your story. It's a remarkable one, but I actually am more interested in what you're doing now and what you're hoping to do in the future. So we'll definitely go into the past, but talk a little bit about what you're doing with your foundation and what you're doing with elementary schools and how you're thinking about transforming this world a little bit. Go into detail on that.
Yeah, you know, I was having dinner with Dabo Swinney and his wife, Kathleen, last summer. My wife and I went to Clemson. Dabo had a virtual fundraiser for Zalman Foundation. He's like, Damon, I need you to help me. I need to make this fundraiser about Be a Coffee Bean. A lot of important organizations depend on me raising money for them. So we did. We went to Clemson. We raised $1 million that night, Brian. And after the fundraiser, we went to dinner that night. And Dabo was telling me about the different groups that he raises money for. And one of these groups is called Call Me Mister. They go into high schools in South Carolina. They find young Black men that are graduating high school. And they give them a scholarship in elementary education to Clemson because less than 2% of the teachers in America are Black men. And so what they're doing is they're going to find young Black men to become elementary school teachers. And then they put these Black men in the toughest elementary schools systems in the state of South Carolina, Title I underperforming, at-risk schools, schools with a majority Black population, a population that looks like them, because there's studies that show, Johns Hopkins studies that show that if a Black boy has a Black male teacher between the ages of second and fifth grade, he's 40% more likely to graduate high school, 20% more likely to become a teacher one day because he's seen that it can be done. He sees himself inside that teacher. And so when Dabo told me about this, my first thought was, how have I never heard of Call Me Mister? But then my next thought was, Dabo, can you introduce me to the Call Me Mister guys? And so I met with them. The guys from Call Me Mister, Dr. Roy Jones and Winston Holton. And I said, guys, listen, here's what I plan on doing. This less than 2% of the number, less than 2% of the teachers in America are Black men. I know a place where half the population is Black men. That's prison, because I was locked up inside of a prison and half the population was Black men almost. So I said, I know that there are other men inside that institution that are Black men that could become teachers one day. Let me find a state that will allow me to go in there and find some Black men to become elementary school teachers, because I did the research. Every state in America allows certain kind of felons to become teachers. I could become a teacher with my organized crime felony because I don't have a violent crime, a crime against kid, a crime against a woman, a crime where there's a physical victim. We don't want those guys anyway. So I found the state of Louisiana to be receptive to it. They said, hey, Damon, you know what? We're all in. No one's ever done this in the history of America before. So what we're in the process of doing right now, Brian, we're identifying 5 men for our first cohort, 5 Black men in the Louisiana prison system. Don't have a lot of time left in the sentence. They're not a serious threat offender. They have the aptitude to test into college. And we're transferring those 5 guys to the Hunt facility outside of Baton Rouge And we're going to bring McNeese State University into the prison system, my foundation, the Be a Coffee Bean Foundation. We're going to pay for these guys to have a scholarship, elementary education. They'll get their elementary degree inside of a prison and get their teacher certification started inside of a prison. And when they parole out of prison, now this is because I've been through the reentry process. I know the extreme barriers for a person coming out of prison. And I tell people all the time that landmines are only dangerous if you don't know where they are. So when these five men come out of prison in 4 years, I'm going to grab each one of them by the hand. And the foundation has a used car for them. We have a wardrobe for them to teach in, a family for them to live with, because a lot of these men didn't come from a good family. They didn't come from a complete unit. We have a mother and a father for them to live with. And we are going to take care of their first year student teacher salary and health care for 1 year, because we don't want to take a guy that's been sitting in a prison and sticking him in a room full of screaming third graders. We want to give this guy a chance to be a student teacher at first. And the foundation pays for all of it. We want no taxpayer money. And these guys go into the toughest elementary schools in the state of Louisiana, Title I at risk, underperforming black schools. And they go and change those school systems from the inside out. The initiative is called Mr. Coffee Bean, combining the Call Me Mr. and Be a Coffee Bean, because these men are the coffee bean in the pot of warm water that is public education. And, it's crazy, Brian, the funding for it fell in. I was speaking to AIG this summer, the corporation, AIG in Manhattan. I did a presentation for their entire company, all 40,000 of their employees, virtually done from their headquarters. When I got done with the presentation, I'm telling Lucy Fato from AIG, who's the head of their pro bono division, about my initiative, Mr. Coffee Bean. And she got back with me. She said, AIG loves it. We want to lead the way. We'll pay for the first five guys, beginning to end of the whole program. Go find your guys. Go find these teachers. So to me, Brian, it's like the smartest form of criminal justice reform. I have a lot of people that contact me because I'm a criminal justice professor at the University of Houston downtown. I teach a class called Prisons in America. I walked out of prison 6 years ago on parole for the rest of my life. But a lot of people contact me about getting involved with their criminal justice reform movements and ideas. And some of them are good, but some of them also are against something. They're against the police. They're against prison. I don't want to be against anything. I want to be for something. And this thing, this initiative right here, it has, pre-interventions for the kids that need it, second chances for guys that have earned it. It's taking the school to prison pipeline and reversing it and making it the prison to school pipeline.
It's amazing. And I'm so curious for you. You're a white male and you grew up in a suburban environment. What did you learn about race while you were in prison?
Yeah. So, to be very specific, I mean, I grew up in a town that was predominantly black. I grew up, the neighborhood I lived in wasn't predominantly black, but the school system I went to was, because the school system I went to in Port Arthur, I was in the gifted and talented program, and their answer to integration in the 1970s was to bus the gifted and talented kids to an all black campus across town. So I went to schools and like my teachers growing up, I had a lot of black men that were teachers because I went to school on the other side of town where most of the black students went. So I grew up in a giant melting pot of a city. My dad was a sports writer down there for 50 years. He was the first sports writer in our part of Texas to put black athletes on the front page of the sports page. 1971 was the first time it ever happened in our region of Texas. And when my dad did that, people lost their minds down there. Man, they broke his windows, they slit his tires, they sent him a bunch of hate mail. And growing up, when my father, saw that we were old enough, my brothers and I, he'd pull that box of hate mail down and he'd make us read every one of those letters of hate mail. Because my dad told us, he said, I want you to see what it is like to take a stand and do the right thing. Because he said, sometimes taking a stand and doing the right thing means you're going to stand alone. And he said, it's always okay to stand alone as long as you stand on the right side of history. So I had that as a guide with me before I went into, and that's like the biggest lesson I would need going into the Texas Department of Criminal Justice, because going into prison, I knew from the people that I was locked up with in county jail that prison was all about race. Race runs the whole institution because all the inmates in there want it to be about race. So, it's so hardcore in there that, they have rows of benches in front of the TV set in the day room on the life sentence building. The first row of benches for the blacks, second row of benches for the Hispanic, third row of benches, if there's a third row, for the white folks. If there's no third row, white people sit on the floor. That's just the way the numbers work in prison, because the numbers are reversed from the free world. Like I said, over 50% of the population is Black men in there. And because it was about race, race runs the whole institution. When I walked in the door there, the white gangs got the first dibs on me. You know, the Aryan Brotherhood, the Aryan Circle, the White Knights, the Woods. I had to fight all these guys for my independence. And when I got done fighting them, then I had to fight the Black gangs, because the white gangs sent the Black gangs after me, the Crips, the Bloods, the Gangster Disciples, Mandingo Warriors. And I had to establish myself and defend myself against this extreme, you know, environment where race was at the center of everything. But I earned my right to walk alone in there. And I think the strongest man in prison always walks alone, doesn't join a gang.
How did you do that? How did you earn the right to walk alone?
Fought. You know, this guy in Dallas County Jail, Mr. Jackson, he told me, he said, you don't have to win all your fights, but you do have to fight all your fights. And what he was telling me is that don't worry about wins and losses in there. Just show up. Somebody challenges you to a fight, you show up. That's all you've got to do. Just keep showing up, even if you lose every single time. And I did. I lost most of my fights. I lost 75% of my fights, but I won because I just kept showing up. And
hey, Damon,
after about 2 months of fighting, the violence was over.
Can you shift to outside of prison now? So it's interesting when you say race is everything inside those walls. It creates a hierarchy. There's a process. And then, look, you get thrown into the fire and you just have to fight. You don't have a choice. Talk about being outside those walls and race and fighting and how you think about that as someone who's not in prison anymore.
Yeah, you know, so interesting. So let's make the transition out of prison. When I'm walking out of prison after 7 years and 3 months, my favorite cellmates is a guy named Sabor, Black Muslim guy from Dallas, 46 years old, just like me now. Sabor's never going to leave prison, not for a long time. I mean, and I take care of Sabor. It's like my brother. I put money in his books all the time and take his phone calls. Sabor stops me on the way out on the sidewalk, and he gives me a hug. You know, it's a very emotional moment for two best friends. And he says, hey, Damon, I got to ask you something before you leave. He said, man, when you get out of here, are you going to talk about the stuff you saw in here, the stuff we talked about in here? Now, what Sabor wants to know, Brian, he wants to know, am I going to talk about the stuff we talked about when we were cellmates, whenever I would learn from my brother Sabor, when he would teach me stuff about racism, disparity in the system, social justice. You know, he wants to know, am I going to talk about that out there where everybody can hear me? And I was like, Sabor, man, when I get on my feet, you know, I will. I promise you, you know, I will. And what he said to me became a call to action in my life, because his words hit me right between the eyes. When he said, good. Good. He said, sometimes they lock up the right guy. Sometimes they lock up the right guy, Brian. And what he means by that is this, that in America, we've got to have more conversations about both racism and the cancel culture, because we're not talking about this stuff enough. And you know, and let's be honest, the cancel culture prevents many of those conversations from happening. I get to operate from a place where I get to talk about the stuff a little bit more than other white people that I notice talk about it. And I'm happy to do that, because I think the conversation needs to be had. And I tell them that if we're going to have dialogue, definitions are important, because if we're not even talking about the same definitions, we're not having the same conversation. So let's talk about racism. Racism is about the imbalance of power. That means one race has more power over another race or other races. They can write laws. That race can write laws to affect where you live, what kind of schools you go to, the kind of America you grow up in, if you're one of the other races. And let's be honest, in America, white people have that kind of power. That's what racism is about, power. Now, when a white friend comes up to me and says, hey, Damon, that person of color over there was being racist or saying something racist, I help my friend out, because definitions are so important, Brian. And I tell my friend, what you're talking about is not racism. What you're talking about is prejudice. And prejudice means to prejudge. That's what prejudice means. And white people can absolutely feel prejudice from another race. But it's very difficult for a white person in America to say that they've experienced racism before, because racism, well, it looks like prejudice, but it's about power. That's what racism is. And so I think there's two reasons why you're not going to find a lot of white people jumping up and down trying to fix the problem of racism in America. Like, seriously, get down to the nitty gritty and fix it. One is that most white people have never experienced racism, so it's a hard threshold to overcome if you haven't experienced something and you're trying to find a solution to it. But the other big obstacle, I think, for white people is that white people are scared to death of the cancel culture. And I understand that, because the cancel culture, no one is immune from the cancel culture. But white people are scared to death of the cancel culture, Brian, because if I'm a white person and I say or do something about race and my intentions are good, but it didn't come out the right way, then I'll lose everything in the process. And the safest play for a white person in America is to just sit down and be quiet, let the protests and the riots stop, because they will. But that's not going to fix anything. You know, and I told you, it's very difficult for a white person to say that they've experienced racism. Not impossible, because I have. I lived in a world, Brian, where for 7 years and 3 months of my life, where I couldn't sit on a certain row of benches because the color of my skin, or the color of my skin means I got my face kicked in on the rec yard some days. So I know what it's like to experience racism in a world where the color of your skin determines how people treat you, even if it's for a brief moment. So I've experienced that. But I do think I have an idea of how we get this conversation started in America. In fact, I just wrote a book about it that'll be out next year called America Needs a Locker Room. But what I think needs to happen is like both sides have got stuff to do. When I say both sides, I'm saying white and black. Here's what I think white people need to do. We'll start with white people. I'm a white person. White people, people that look like you and me, we're going to have to get off the sidelines and get into the game and start listening to what black and brown people are telling us about racism in America. We need to start listening and then being willing to be able to be part of the solution once we understand that. That's going to take a lot of humility from white people. Now, that's what white people are going to have to do. Black people are going to have, they're going to have to invite these white people who come with humility and are willing to learn and listen. You're going to have to, if you're a black person, you're going to have to invite these white people into these conversations in these rooms with grace. And when you invite someone into a room with grace, where there is grace present, that means there is no more cancel culture. Because grace says that you may not say or do the right thing, but that's okay. You're not going to lose everything in the process because you came with humility, willing to learn and listen. I'm going to be willing to teach with grace. And grace always costs, it always costs more on the person giving it than the person receiving it. That's just the nature of grace. But when humility and grace are present, there's no room for racism or the cancel culture. And that's what I think America needs to move towards.
It's so interesting. I had a previous guest on the podcast right after the John Gruden stuff broke. And I went on a little bit of a riff because to me, when we cancel John Gruden or whoever the next person will be, we shut down the conversation. We shut down the dialogue. And we all know this stuff is everywhere. It's not like, first of all of us have our own biases and our own shit inside of us. So none of us are better than anybody else. And two, like whenever something not ideal happens, we need to open it up more rather than close it down. And for me, like I majored in sociology in college. I minored in African American studies. I was exposed to stuff in high school that has impacted me drastically today. And throughout my life, there have been moments that I got chills when you talked about what you were doing with Call Me Mister and what you're creating on your end. But to me, it's like, we need institutional change and we need to teach people to also overcome challenges. We need to embrace difficult conversations, even if they make us feel uncomfortable. And we need to hold people accountable for what they say and their actions. And I don't know why we have to be at this place where it's either or and it's not an and situation. Like, we need to continue to evolve. And you said, listen, and as a white male, like, when George Floyd happened, I'd been listening. Like, I'd been listening. So it's not just listening. We also need to go take action and go speak up. And I think for a lot of white people, you have to be willing to do that. I don't happen to work for a company, so I'm not going to get fired for speaking out and saying the wrong thing. I could lose business for sure. But for me, I think it is different when you're part of a bigger organization and you can lose your job for saying the wrong thing. And the last thing I'll say is I've co-facilitated a lot of diversity, equity, inclusion conversations with companies. And I'm the white male. I do it with an African-American woman. And it's amazing because a lot of people are just scared. They're scared to speak up because there are consequences for them.
Justifiably so. They're justifiably scared. Brian, the cancel culture is real, man. And the cancel culture, you hit it on the head a while ago. It prevents the conversation from even happening because, like I said, white people that may have good intentions will be quiet and sit back and not say a word now because the cancel culture is so visceral and real. The cancel culture is awful. That's why I say when I'm going to talk about racism, I'm talking about racism and the cancel culture, because we're not going to have a conversation about one without talking about the other one, because that's not right. We're not going to sit there and say we're going to make all white people feel bad because of racism. I get that. You've got to start with white people if we're having a conversation about racism. But if we're going to open up the door and we're going to talk about racism, let's talk about that cancel culture too, because that is a problem. That's something that's keeping us back from fixing any of the problem of racism. And it's keeping a lot of good people out of the conversation. And look, man, that cancel culture, you know, no one is immune from it, Brian. No one is immune from it. And what you have right now in America, you have a whiplash of the effect of everything. I mean, you know, after the murder of George Floyd, I mean, and people were rightly upset about that. I mean, it's violent, awful murder that happened in the streets of Minneapolis, Minnesota. But it went so far the other direction. It's like why the Democratic Party is doing so poorly right now in elections. I mean, you know, people want to start hearing what the solution is and say, hey, look, you know what, we hear what the problem is, but let's start trying to figure out a solution. But no one's offering up solutions. That's going to take both black and white people to figure this out together. White people can't fix this on their own. They certainly hold a lot of the cards because white people have a lot of the power, but the power is being sidelined because of the cancel culture. And look, this isn't some abstract idea that I came up with and said, hey, you know what? I think this sounds great. No, I practice this in my own life. This Mr. Coffee Bean initiative that I did where I'm finding black men and turning them into elementary school teachers that are guys in prison, never been done before. But my thing is this, just because it's never been done before doesn't mean it can't be done. When I have listened to what black men and women have told me, I listen just like I'm saying white people need to listen. What I have heard from them is like, yes, Damon, y'all do have the power. And what we need you to do is help transfer some of that power back to us so we can fix our communities. But we don't necessarily need you standing over our shoulder the whole time when we transfer that power back over. Let us go fix our communities, because that's what I hear from a lot of black men and women, is they want to fix their communities, but they need some of that power transferred over to them, and they don't need us hovering over them when they do it. So you know what? When I heard that, I'm like, when Dabo told me about the Mr. Coffee Bean, call me Mr. This is great. This is a chance for me to practice what I preach, because now I'm going to empower these black men to go into their communities and be a positive black male role model in a place that may be lacking young, positive black male role models. And I'm not going to be around them. I'm not going to be standing in their classroom saying, look at this guy that I help out. No, these guys are going to be in there fixing their own communities because they have power in that community that I could never have anyway, man. And sometimes it's what it's about. When you're white, you just need to understand that your place is not up there in front. Your place is to empower this community to fix their own communities. And I think that's what black people want to do anyway.
For sure. You said earlier, you said you were gifted and talented, and so much so, you know, you went to a different school. It's clear, I think, we're 20 minutes into this conversation. I think people would say, oh, this guy's got some talent, right? Talk about being gifted and talented as a youngster, how it helped you, maybe how it hindered you in other ways. I'm curious, because I was never labeled gifted and talented. I was around other people that were labeled that way. I like to say I was kind of mediocre when I was a kid. And I think that's okay. We could talk about that on another podcast. But for you, being labeled gifted and talented, how did that impact your life?
Yeah. I mean, look, here's the thing. I mean, we can keep it on the conversation of race too. I mean, look, there's, when I was in prison, I'm gonna answer your question, but I'll back it up going through prison again. When I was in prison, I was a sociology major in college. I got my bachelor's in sociology. So you and I have the same degree. Living in prison was like living in a giant sociological petri dish, Brian. I mean, it was literally like waking up in a lab every day. This is a giant lab experiment. And if you're a sober observer, there's some data to be found in there, man. I mean, I'm walking around it, Brian. I mean, there's no telling what you're going to see inside that place every single day. You're watching human beings interact in a way that you don't ever get to see. It's all hypothetical when you're reading it in a book, but inside this place, I'm looking around and I start asking questions because I want to gather some of the data of what's going on around me, because I want to understand my environment. And I start seeing that there's certain variables that determine whether or not someone is justice involved, whether or not they have had a negative interaction with the criminal justice system, or more likely to have a negative interaction, because nothing's guaranteed. I don't care where you come from. It's not guaranteed you have to go there, right? But here's some variables. Here are the variables. There's five. Poverty, lack of education, lack of a home, a family unit, right? And race, and then there's substance abuse. These are the five things that I noticed. But poverty, lack of education, and the breakdown of the family home, these are the top three, man. I mean, and you know, you put race up there next, but really it's substance abuse, because 80% of the people locked up have substance abuse issues. Now, of the five, I only had substance abuse. I'm an outlier in so many ways. Like you said, 20 minutes into this conversation, some of your people probably wondering, how did this guy end up in a maximum security prison serving a life sentence? Well, the odds are that a guy like me never sees the inside of a maximum security prison.
I grew up in a wealthy suburb outside Washington, D.C. I grew up with my buddy Adam. Adam's not alive anymore. Like, you know, and Adam grew up in an environment that's as loving and nurturing in our community. He passed away 2 years ago. He overdosed. And so I think I'd love to hear more on substance abuse, because I think a lot of people are ignorant to what it is and how it shows up. So I know I interrupted you, but I think it's worth noting that you're not an N of one in that way. It might have shown in different ways, but Adam was at times heading down paths that I think were similar to the paths. You were a good looking guy, good at sports. Like, I love Adam.
But you know, and being the substance abuse stuff. Yeah. I mean, there's nothing that says that, you know, the suburbs have substance abuse issues less than the inner cities. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that I'm an outlier for a person to go to prison. When the parole board interviewed me, they said that point blank. I mean, the lady that interviewed me for parole, she said, we don't see a lot of people come to the state prisons like you, Mr. West. You had everything going for your life, every advantage, every opportunity, every privilege. She said, you were a privileged person, but I blew through all of that, became a drug addict and a criminal and a thief. And a jury gave me life in prison. But the thing about it is that, you know, growing up the way I did, the odds were like more likely that I was going to come from a two-parent home, and which I did. My parents have still been married for 53 years. I didn't come from a broken home. The odds are that I would have access to more educational opportunities. And I did. I mean, I was gifted and talented. And I mean, you know, not that all that is like, you know, growing up in a white family, but I mean, education was pushed really hard in my home. You know, I have two parents that value education, their home, that they make sure I have every opportunity I need to get a good education. There's variables that being white has afforded me. You know, and so when I come up for parole, even they're looking at a guy on paper that I've got a great support system. I've got all these different things in my background. I mean, I've got a bachelor's degree. I worked in Congress. I worked for a guy running for president. I worked on Wall Street before I went to prison. This is a state prison system. Most people have a seventh grade education, and they've got a look at this guy with all this stuff. And I got a family waiting for me when I got to get out, man, with a home that they live in the suburbs, you know, and a vehicle they've already got for me and all this other stuff. Not everybody has that, man. Not everybody has that. So I do acknowledge that race plays a factor in everything in our lives, including me making parole. Now, we'll go to the flip side of that. Did race play a factor in me getting 65 years for organized crime, meth-related property crimes, my first felony conviction ever, and I got life in prison? And I would argue that no, my race did not help me with that. And I thought going into it, white middle-class guy, I've got two paid attorneys, man. I got the system. I mean, most people go through there with a court-appointed attorney, and people of color are so negatively impacted with sentencing guidelines in America. But dude, I got hit with a life sentence. So where you can say on one hand that race, it was a factor to help me make parole, and I acknowledge that. I also want to acknowledge, though, if we're gonna acknowledge that, let's acknowledge the fact that my race did not help me whenever I went in front of a jury. In fact, it was probably something that was used against me, because here's a guy in front of the jury that had every opportunity, every advantage, every privilege in life, and I blew through all of that, and this is what I became. The jury was disgusted with me, and I gave them every reason to hate me, man. But the criminal justice system didn't have a lot of Damon West in it. I didn't see a lot of people that looked like me, that spoke like me. In fact, I was such an outlier in there that, I mean, people hated me, white, black, Hispanic, everybody, because I look and spoke like the man. And the man was the one that put them in there as far as what they're, that's the mindset in there. The man put me here. So the man had devoured one of its own, and everybody was happy to get a piece of the man when I got into prison.
How did you survive? You talk about fighting, but then there's got to be a moment where that subsides, you build relationships. I know you talk about Mr. Jackson having a big influence on you. What allowed you to persevere that environment, that ecosystem?
No, I mean, faith, first of all. I mean, I gave up the idea that I had control in life anymore. When I got sentenced to life in prison, that day was my rock bottom moment. And, you know, got into a 12-step program recovery in prison. And this 12-step program recovery, the first three steps, you admit that you're powerless. You turn over control to your higher power. I mean, and I'm a Christian, mine's Christ. But anybody can pick their own higher power. I'm not saying that you have to choose Christianity, but that was mine. I'm a Christian. But when I went through this program recovery, it taught me things about what I do and do not control. I control what I think, what I say, what I feel, and what I do, and that I can clean out the personal baggage in my life. You know, when you're working through the steps, you're working through all your resentments, your hates, your anger, the frustrations, the fears that you have. Fears are big. You work through all that. You work through all your list of people that you've harmed, and you try to make apologies to the people that you can, where it doesn't cause you or them harm. You make amends everywhere you go. What you're doing inside there, Brian, what I'm doing inside there is I'm becoming my own custodian. I'm becoming my own garbage man, because I'm cleaning the garbage out of my life, the stuff that holds me back in life, and I'm keeping my side of the street clean. And that's what I learned in prison. I learned to keep my side of the street clean. I can't control what other people do on their side of the street. In fact, I tell people all the time, one of the most important jobs in society, one of the most important jobs in all of society is a sanitation worker, someone you would call the garbage man. Because if the garbage man decides tomorrow, all of these garbage men in the world decide tomorrow, they're not doing their jobs anymore, society breaks down, and it breaks down fast, because no one wants to live in a world where trash is all over the streets, trash is piled higher than houses. No one wants to live in a world like that. And your life is the same way. You are your own garbage man in life. You are your own sanitation worker. If you don't clean that baggage and that trash out of from inside of you, you're going to break down too. And we break down in different ways in life. And in life, I learned in my program recovery, I've just got to keep my side of the street clean. And as long as I keep my side of the street clean, then I'm going to be the best version of Damon West going out every day, whether it's walking out the cell door or walking out my front door. Now in life, I just worked on being the best version of myself and tried to control the things I could control.
Many people say that addiction is a lifelong disease and it's a lifelong challenge. What do you do today to make sure that your side of the street is clean and that you're staying clean as well?
I agree. I mean, I think it is. It's absolute disease. If you had cancer or lupus or AIDS or whatever, if you had a disease and someone said, hey, here's a pill, take this pill every day for the rest of your life. And if you take this pill every day for the rest of your life, you're going to live to a long old age. You're going to have these great memories and you're not going to have to worry about your disease. Would you take the pill, Brian?
Yeah, of course.
Absolutely. You would take the pill. You would say, well, give me the pill and make sure I have enough prescription to last me for the rest of my life. That's what a program of recovery is for an addict. Because as an addict, addicts can get better, but they'll never get well. You're not going to get healed if you're an addict. If you're truly an addict like me, because here's what an addict does. Addicts, we give up our goals to meet our behaviors. Normal people give up their behaviors to meet their goals. Addicts don't do that. Because addicts have a three-part thought process. We have a thought. Let's say the thought is to drink or do drugs. And then we obsess on that thought. And it could be a week, it could be a month, it could be a year. You think about having a drink again, then eventually it becomes physical. Thought, obsess, becomes physical. You put in. Drinking and drugs is not the problem for any addict out there, including myself, because I'm an addict. I'm in recovery now. Drinking and drugs aren't the problem. It's a symptom of the problem. The problem is something inside you that you need to clean out. You need to work on your own personal health, mental and emotional, spiritual health. So today, what I do, Brian, I have a program recovery. I belong to AA, and people in AA are probably going to go, their heads might explode when they hear me say that publicly, because they're like, oh, you don't represent AA. Yeah, I don't represent AA, but I go to AA meetings. I'm not going to be anonymous about it, because I think that when other people see examples of someone that, hey, this is what they're doing and it's working for them, then that's something it might bring them to program recovery too. And in my program recovery, I mean, I go to two or three meetings a week still. I'll do this for the rest of my life. My sponsor, man, I talk to my sponsor almost daily, and I work the steps every year. I'm going to go back through the entire 12 steps and work it again, because I'm going to accumulate garbage in my life. And that program recovery gives me the tools I need to live a normal life. It allows me to, like, if I have a thought, and I've had a thought before about drinking, I call my sponsor and I say, hey, man, I had this crazy thought about drinking. And then he walks me through it. He said, okay, great. You use your first tool, which is to call somebody in the program. Let's do the next tool, which is play the tape out all the way to the end. It'll take me from where that drink would have taken me. You know, just that one drink could take me all the way back into prison where I'm in the chow hall now eating pork noodle casserole. That's a valuable tool to have. But if I don't have a program recovery, I don't have those tools. And so many people, especially coming out of prison, remember, we're going back to the number I said, 80% of the people incarcerated have substance abuse issues. Those 80% of the people that get out that have substance abuse issues, when they get into life, if they don't have a program recovery, this is where recidivism is so high in America. My thought on it, if you don't have a program recovery, you're getting out of prison, life is going to be hard. Life's going to be tough. It's tough being a formerly incarcerated person. Not impossible, but tough. But eventually, your life is going to be difficult to the point that you're going to think about doing drugs again. You're going to think about drinking again. And when you do have those thoughts, you need to have something to be able to do with that with a program recovery. And if you don't have a program recovery, you're going to be one of those 75% of the people that goes back to prison in the first 3 years. It's always about substance abuse. And, you know, you talked about it a while ago about addiction in America. There's two things we got to change our attitudes towards in this country. It's substance abuse and mental health. We have failed as we are such a failure as a nation as a whole for dealing with these two mental diseases, mental health and substance abuse, because what we've done for generations is locked up a bunch of sick people. And now our prisons are full, a bunch of sick. And I get having to go to prison because you make a mistake. I deserve to go to prison, Ryan. I don't ever pull any punches about that. But when I was in prison, the only help that I was going to get from my disease of addiction is stuff that I would have to do on my own voluntarily, because there's no programs that are offered that says, hey, you have to go do this, which is, it's a double-edged sword, because the addict has to want to do it him or herself before it can even be possible. But, you know, when I got locked up, like I told the parole lady, I need help. And if you're going to parole me out, I want your parole option that has a substance abuse treatment program facility I can go to for the last 6 months I'm in prison, because I want all the help the state of Texas can give me. And they gave me that, Brian. I asked for that.
When I had Chris Wilson on, and we talked about Chris a little bit before we started recording, he mentioned, and he mentions it in his book as well, that there are people in prison that are bad and probably aren't coming back around. But there are a bunch of other people that still have potential to turn their life around. What's your thought on good and bad, and how do you think about good and evil as it relates to life?
Yeah, you know, prison changed the way I see humans in a lot of ways. I saw some stuff in there that I could never unsee, and Chris did too. Stuff you can never unhear. But I also saw some humanity in there. You know, I saw what I would call the face of God. When you see, you know, one inmate helping another inmate out, when you see an inmate that sees a person that's indigent and they go and just privately, without everybody knowing, they go and buy them, you know, their hygiene needs, a toothpaste, deodorant, a toothbrush, toilet paper, and drop them off in their cell, not when anybody can see it, but just to do it, to be a human. You see stuff like that in there. But he's right. There are some very bad people in there. There's some very bad people there. There's people in there that don't ever need to get out. I was sentenced to the life sentence part of the Texas Max Security Prison because I have a life sentence. So I lived with the hardest of the hardest, the worst of the worst. And you had to change my mind about what a bad guy and a good guy looks like. For example, I had a cellmate, this guy named Carlos, man, he's in my book, The Change Agent. Carlos was a bank robber from San Antonio. He was serving 99 years for a bunch of bank robberies he did. But Carlos is one of the best guys I've ever met. You know, I love Carlos, and he's a bank robber. So you got to change your idea of what a good guy and a bad guy is. Bank robber, not so bad. Child molester, rapist, murderer. Yeah, now you're dealing with something else. But I'll go even further. Let's take murderers, all right? Give me a murderer for a cellmate any day of the week inside of a prison. You know why? And I'm going to tell you the most candid answer to this question. Give me a murderer any day over a child molester or a rapist. Because here's the deal. I can wrap my brain around the crime of murder. Because I, just like most people in the world, have had homicidal thoughts before. Most people have had a homicidal thought. Like, I'd like to kill that son of a bitch, but they don't act on it. You know, 99.99999% of the people that have had a homicidal thought will never act on it. But most people have had that thought. But I've never had a thought about raping a woman or hurting a child or doing something that could could grievously injure a human being that I've never had a thought about doing something like that. I can't wrap my brain around that. So if I can't wrap my brain around your crime, I don't want to be living with you in the same cell. So that's kind of the line I drew. But if you read my book, The Change Agent, you'll see that I had to evolve when I was in prison, especially with child molesters. I had a hard time because there's so many child molesters in the life in this building. And I had a hard time of seeing them human. But I finally got to the place where I saw them as human, Brian. And it's because I had to realize that I am a flawed person too. And in someone's eyes, I'm a monster. And I want to be forgiven. I want people to accept me. And the reason why I came around to accepting them as humans that had made some horrible mistakes, but need to pay a serious price, it's because who am I to judge? Who am I to judge you? I'm a flawed human being. And if my time is spent judging you, then I'm not living in my program recovery. So the program recovery has taught me to accept life on life's terms, to not judge people for their mistakes, because that's not for me to do. It's not my place to judge anybody else. But I tell you what, man, there are some dangerous people inside those places. There's a reason why we build prisons, Brian. There's a reason why we put some people in prison that'll never get out. But remember this number, 95% of the people that are incarcerated in America, whether it's jails, prisons, whatever, 95% of the people that are incarcerated get out of prison one day. 95% of the 3.8 million will go home one day.
I'm going to connect you with Chris. Chris committed a murder, but he talks about his environment. He talks about what happened when that happened. And he was a teenager. And the two of you are just, I just want to see what happens when I put the two of you together.
I can't wait, because I mean, I know that he can tell you the same thing that I tell people all the time. I was talking to the people in Louisiana. Somebody asked me, Damon, what's to stop these guys from, because I mean, in the program, these guys have to give us back 5 years as teachers, you know? And somebody in the state of Louisiana government said, Damon, what's to stop these guys from just going out the first year, getting your car, your first year salary and all that, and leaving and ghosting on you, right? I said, well, here's the deal. Here's why that's not going to happen. Because in America, punishment never stops. And I told this woman, she was a white woman. I told her, you wouldn't understand this because you've never been incarcerated, and I'm a formerly incarcerated person. I could tell you, Damon West on paper, I've got a master's degree. I've got best-selling books. I've got a movie getting ready to be made about my life, a Netflix limited series. I'm a criminal justice professor, you know, that's formerly incarcerated. But if I had to go to work tomorrow for someone else, there are so many jobs I'll never be able to get because I'm going to check this one box that says I'm a felon. And that means that punishment never stops, because the state of Texas has let me go. They've said, hey, you've done your time. You're doing your time on parole. But society does not let it go. And Chris knows this. Chris knows that punishment never stops. So I told her, I said, these guys coming out of prison, these black men, they have nothing on paper like Damon West, who can't get a job at most places because he's a felon. They're coming out with a degree from McNeese State University in elementary education. No one cares about their degree, but you did. You gave them a job inside your educational system. So what they're going to do is, I'm going to tell you their path. They're going to become teachers. Then they're going to become principals. Then they're going to become administrators. Then they're going to become superintendents. And they may end up running your state board of education one day because they have nowhere else to go. Education is the only place they can go because you gave them a chance.
It's so good. It's so good. Look, you are in Texas and you are giving multiple speeches, it sounds like, and we're recording this. It looks like you're in a hotel room.
Yeah.
Well, why go on this mission of speaking? We've talked about the foundation. We've talked a little bit about the book writing, but why speaking? Like, why is it that you're pouring your heart and soul into making an impact on others and speaking?
Because I think that when we can see examples of people and how they overcome their adversity, but better yet, they can tell us exactly how they did it. That is valuable. That has currency, because we need to see examples of people that did get it right. You know, there's several reasons why I do it, but the main reason is that I think that my story brings hope to so many people. It gives a lot of perspective on what a bad day looks like. Most people's biggest fear, Brian, is to go to prison. And I didn't just go to prison. I got sent to the bowels of that place. And I came out the best version of myself possible. And people look at me, they're like, man, if I didn't know you and and didn't know that the story was real, I wouldn't believe your story. And I'm like, I get that. But you cannot deny what you can see. And I want to be an example for other people. I want to show people how much more they are capable of than what they think. Because there's so much that adversity, there's two things that I've that held me back with adversity, is that I'm always capable of way more than I think I am. And adversity is never as bad as I think it's going to be. We, as humans, often let overthinking get in the way of overcoming. And I want to share them with them a story about what you can do when you decide that you're going to be like that coffee bean, right? But I also want to use my story, my example, as a catalyst to further the conversation on difficult topics like racism in America. You know, not every group I go talk to, by the way, wants me to come in there and talk about that. But some do. And the U.S. Army brings me into the Army bases because they wanted me to talk about racism because they're dealing with that in the U.S. Army. There's companies. This presentation I did today with the Texas mortgage bankers, they wanted me to talk about the racial component because they want the conversation to get started. I think most people want to get this conversation started because my story, one of the big things about my story and why I tell it is that we are so much more alike than we are different. And we've got to find a place where we can talk and have those conversations. That's why the next book that's coming out is called America Needs a Locker Room. Because sports has always been first, Brian. Sports got there before everybody. Before there was Martin Luther King Jr., there was Jackie Robinson. Sports gets there first. And sports brings people together like nothing else would. You see people in high school football stands on a Friday night hugging each other that would never hug each other anywhere else in public. Maybe in church, but you see them doing that. Sports can do that. And a team that wins games, they have a healthy locker room. Because if they don't have a healthy locker room, they don't win anything. A divided locker room, you don't win the thing. But in a healthy locker room, your success is my success. Everyone has a voice. A mistake doesn't necessarily make you a mistake. There's a path to become whole again. And the standard is the standard. And America doesn't have a locker room right now. But I wrote a book for it. It'll be coming out probably late May, early June. America Needs a Locker Room, brother.
So, Damon, that's a great place for us to close. I'm excited to read it. If people want to learn more about you, where can they follow you on social? I know you're active there. And if people want to get involved with what you're doing with AIG and the foundation, where can people help? I'm going to give you a megaphone to plug and support anything that you believe deserves more attention.
Yeah, my social media, Twitter and Instagram, same thing, at DamonWest7, DamonWest7. My website, where you can find everything out about me that you want. My books are on there, www.damonwest.org. And my foundation website is www.beacoffeebeanfoundation.org. Beacoffeebeanfoundation.org. Brian, hey, man, thanks a lot for today, brother.
Thanks. I'm on Twitter at Brian Levinson. LinkedIn is the other place I like to play at Brian Levinson. You can listen to all of these conversations at strongskills.co/podcast. Damon, thanks so much for your time. I know you're a busy man. Appreciate you and looking forward to meeting you when you come through DC. And maybe we'll grab a coffee, even though I drink tea, and we'll get to hang for a little bit longer. Thanks for the time.
Awesome, brother. Appreciate you, Brian. Thanks, brother.
Thank you for listening to Intentional Performers with Brian Levinson. Here is this week's episode gem.
And that's what I learned in prison. I learned to keep my side of the street clean. I can't control what other people do on their side of the street. In fact, I tell people all the time, one of the most important jobs in society, one of the most important jobs in all of society is a sanitation worker, someone you would call the garbage man. Because if the garbage man decides tomorrow, all these garbage men in the world decide tomorrow, they're not doing their jobs anymore. Society breaks down, and it breaks down fast because no one wants to live in a world where trash is all over the streets, trash is piled higher than houses. No one wants to live in a world like that. And your life is the same way. You are your own garbage man in life. You are your own sanitation worker. If you don't clean that baggage and that trash out of from inside of you, you're going to break down too. And we break down in different ways in life.